Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. It's the flannel panel today, so I'm joined by Joe Heschmeyer, apologist extraordinaire, wonderful speaker, wonderful writer, the author of the new book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
And also joined by the president of Catholic Answers, Chris Check. Chris Check, welcome back. Thanks for coming back.
I'm glad to be back. I wasn't gone that long. It was just a couple of minutes.
I know, but you never know what'll happen. Yeah. You know, you could just storm
it's
out.
It's like
disgusted.
A golden retriever. He's just happy to see you. He's just wagging his tail every time you come back to the room.
All right, so what do you guys think? That's our first guest ever on Flannel Panel. Would you do a guest again?
I think we should make a poll.
Oh, we should ask
biased.
People.
Simone introduced me to my wife, so, you know, I'm never going to
Oh, I didn't mean just Simone. I just meant any guest at all. But, okay, so you just tell us on Facebook or YouTube if you think we should have Simone back. And if your answer is no, don't participate.
I give her an A. I think she did a great job.
She always gets an A. I really enjoy talking with Simone. One of the things that I enjoy about speaking with Simone, like yourself, Joe Heschmeyer, as an apologist, and I've often thought this about a lot of our apologists around here, is it's not predictable. It doesn't feel rote with her. Like sometimes I'll ask a question or a question, somebody will call, and you go, "Oh, I'm surprised by that answer." She wanted
yeah.
to, and not because
but
it's
in
a wrong
way.
Answer.
Not like, yeah, but yeah, if people are right. heretics, you get that too.
But not like that. Just like there's often a level of thought that I don't know that I wouldn't have hit. Just that I you get that with Jimmy sometimes. So somebody asks Jimmy a question, and you go, I really wonder how Jimmy's going to answer this one. How this is going to go? Yeah. It's always going to be a Catholic answer, but there's a lot of variety within that category of Catholic answers.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I'm sharing tales out of school here. I was talking with somebody from the Coming Home Network today, and they were saying that what we do is really similar, but that where they see Catholic answers is sometimes more propositional, they're more narrative. Like, they just let people tell their stories.
And those two approaches go
really well together, yeah. You know? And because, obviously, they both are true and valid. I think what made Scott Hahn's book, Rome Sweet Home, so successful and so popular is that he was sharing all that propositional stuff in a really narrative, personal testimony kind of way.
Yeah.
And so it appeals to both groups.
I think I said this on the air not too long ago. Marcus's son has done a superb job taking over from his dad.
Yeah.
And now I'm trying to remember his.
You're trying to remember Marcus Grody's son's
what's
name?
What's Marcus Grody's son's name? Who is it?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
really?
What is it?
Deacon Peter Grody? John Mark Grody?
No, John Mark. John Mark, thank you.
I can't even. I'm just.
No, I think he's a superb interviewer. And
to me, like, there are certain things like in Catholic media that are that they're like, oh, that just worked. I honestly think, but long before I was ever associated with it, I think Catholic Answers Live is one of those things. That format of ask any question you want about the Catholic faith and get an answer. The whole Marcus Grody thing is another one of those.
I agree.
Like, I hope it never goes away. It's just so good. I love listening to it.
Well,
can I make two quick points on both those things?
Yeah.
One, I think what makes Catholic Answers Live work as a format is partly that it's radio. So you're not trying to hit a word count. And so an answer can go as short or as long as it needs to. And the only thing
it never goes as short as it needs to. We've never had a
sense, every time
oh, that was as short as it needed to be.
We've got 5 minutes left. Can you make this quick? They're like, well, once in sixth grade. This isn't related to my story, but I thought I'd share this.
My father took
like
me to the zoo.
To everyone. It's like, slow down. I love it. But I mean, other than the breaks, you know, it's a much more open-ended kind of format, which is great.
Yeah.
What I learned about the Coming Home Network today is that they provide a ton of assistance to
tons
like Protestant pastors and things who are discerning the Catholic Church and they're freaked out because their entire livelihood is being, you know, a minister of such and such denomination.
They face becoming destitute. They face losing all of their friends. That's a very difficult thing. No,
Marcus it's extraordinary.
He's a heroic figure in the history of the church here in America.
And just a good interviewer. Like, he's a relaxed interviewer who lets people tell their stories. He takes it in an interesting direction. He takes interest in the thing that the listener takes an interest in. I think it's all great.
Well, Cy, I'm going to say you and he and John Mark share this skill. And one of the things that an interviewer needs he has to have that conversational style. He has to be a good listener. But he also has to have a certain amount of breadth. And on Coming Home, and I'm not referring to your waistline there. Sorry.
It's unnecessary, Chris. Just unnecessary. Yeah, yeah.
So,
go ahead.
on Coming Home, and here when we do Focus also, but on Coming Home, people come to the Catholic Church from a billion different directions.
Right. That's so fascinating.
And,
yes.
And both Grodis are adept, quite skillful and natural at just because they know a lot. And so someone, I don't know, is a concert pianist and that brought him into the church, whatever. And I hear one of these guys talking about, you know, a piano sonata, a Mozart sonata or something. Where do the Grodis, how do the Grodis know? That, I just made that one up, but I'm sure it happened. But they,
I had a friend who was on the show, John Leindecker, who talked about how he was a car thief and then became a Catholic.
Yeah, exactly. And the Grodis had
a quick question. Did he give up the car thieving coverage, or did he stay with the car thieving?
Officially, yes. I don't know how he gets all these cars, but
he's got a very full driveway, but he's Catholic now.
He's got 10-11 kids, so you know, I wouldn't begrudge him a car or two.
You know, the third thing that I think another absolutely perennial is any question and answer with Mother Angelica. And I don't know why they stopped doing those. I don't know why they stopped making those. Those were great.
I don't know how to tell you this.
What, you have bad news for me?
Terrible news.
Like, I feel terrible telling you this, but I like they do the replays now. I just love them.
That's a dumb question. I don't know if she's ever quite put it that way, but you kind of hear it in the, like, why are you asking that?
But she does it. I don't know. She's very funny. And I think when people talk about how holy she is and how trusting, also she was just hilarious. Yeah. She just had a great sense of humor. So that helps. The number here is 888-318-7884. I'm mostly just giving it out to disappoint you. But is anybody even answering the phones over there, Darren? No, there's nobody answering the phones today. It's Flannel Panel. We're talking about the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. You should come to Rome with us. We're all going. We're all going to wear our flannel shirts. And it's going to be nice flannel weather because we're going in November, the time you should be in Rome. Not when all the crazy people are in Rome, when the people who have the sense to go where you can have some freedom, you can sit down in a restaurant, you can walk through the streets and not sweat yourself to death. Come with us to Rome in November.
The Synod on Synodality will be over.
Oh, will it? Doggone it. Well, that was bad planning on our part.
Here's what I want to tell you. We have my favorite hotel in Rome, and it's called the Hotel Forum. Look it up. It is an elegant, it's what they call a superior four-star hotel. It is an elegant place. It's an old, 18th century building. It's been really well cared for. It's a delightful hotel. Once, long, long ago, I smoked a cigar in the lobby of the Hotel Forum when it was not against the law. And when I could smoke a cigar and it wouldn't keep me awake at night. But
the Romans won't let you smoke a cigar in the lobby?
Not anymore.
What are they, Californians?
Europe is over, man.
It is.
You can't even smoke in Paris.
No, ever since, yeah. So
I didn't know any of this.
The rooftop restaurant has a beautiful view of the Forum. All that aside, and it's a lovely property, you'll be very happy and comfortable there. It is right in the middle of any direction in which you want to set out on foot, which is how we do this tour. We'll have a bus for a day or two to get, you know, to St. Paul outside the walls, or San Lorenzo outside the walls, or St. Agnes outside the walls. But most of this we're going to do on foot. And in any direction.
Even though the Synod on Synodality is over, we're still going to be walking together.
Nicely done, Joe. Synodality. We're going to live it.
Yeah,
exactly. We're going to be models of synodality in Rome.
So whether you're headed towards the Aventine or over to the historic center or to the Holy See or behind you to the Esquiline or to the Caelian where John Lateran is, in any direction, a short walk to one of the things we're going to see. So the location of this hotel is perfect.
Yeah.
I just checked. to get to, you know, the famous so-called wedding cake, the monument to Victor Emmanuel II, yeah. If you've ever seen, like...
Oh, it's like two steps from there, isn't it?
It's close.
Yeah, yeah. It's an 11-minute walk. It's not bad at all.
So, yeah, okay, so...
Yeah, it really is right in the middle.
So that monstrosity we will mock when we go to Rome, but...
It does look like a joke. It looks like if you were like, you know what, I'm going to make something better than all the other monuments in Rome, and then you just overdo it in every way.
And then you put giant statues on top of the monstrosity. It is amazing. Yeah, yeah. It is like, yeah, we could take notes on how to do that.
But it is...
It looks like it belongs in Vegas.
It does.
It does. It looks like a fake monument. Yeah.
I think it was in Vegas. It's one of those that they take apart and then they
put it back together. Yeah, yeah, like the London Bridge.
But you're right. It is right next to the Capitoline Hill, Capitoline Museum, of course, Santa Maria Arcelli. That was the center of Rome. So it's
wonderful. Yeah.
Cosmas and Damian.
What's that square where that you look down? It's underground, but you see the spot where Julius Caesar was killed.
Yeah, that's called the Forum.
It's called the Hotel Forum.
Steps away.
No, that's not the Forum.
Okay, as you were, where I was thinking where he's buried, Largo Argentina.
Yeah,
the Largo Argentina.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
with the cats. You should come with us. This is going to be great.
So
CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. We have a few spots left.
Yeah, we can take 10 more couples. That's it.
All right. And we're not putting another bus on. We're not.
Nope.
That's not happening. We're determined to keep this very small.
Yes.
And we're going to just have a great time.
50 people, not 50 buses.
CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com.
Save $300 if you register before July 31st per person.
What? I thought I had extended it when I did it. It's all the way till July
31st? I did. I extended it.
Oh, you have so much more power than I have.
I just want everybody who can come to Rome to come to Rome.
Yeah, come with us.
As long as it's no more than 50.
I want everyone to come up to 50. Catholic.
All are welcome. Limit 50.
CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hi, this is Doug Keck on Mother Angelica Answering the Call. Father Joseph Mary and I mine decades of phone calls answered by Mother Angelica. Join us Sunday for a half hour of teaching, advice, laughter, and plenty of prayers from the one and only Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica Answering the Call, Sunday afternoon, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. It's the news of the day from a Catholic perspective today. It's the flannel panel. And we're all wearing flannel, which is actually, I think, might be a record for the flannel panel. Everyone remembered to wear their flannel today. We're known for our deep and important insights, not for our sartorial choices, okay? Well, sometimes we forget our shirts. 888-318-7884.
I look pretty good.
You always look good.
Effortlessly cool.
You have that quality, and it's because you skipped the sixth grade to go to a school that formed you into a human being. I don't know what you were before that.
The jury's out.
Well, you have some humane qualities. You have some human qualities. I got a story from you from the world's greatest writer and deepest thinker, David Brooks of the New York Times.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my.
He is. Ask him. No, I'm just kidding. He would not. He's not an arrogant person. He's also not a very insightful person.
This is why I don't have you introduce me at talks, by the way.
Oh, do you remember the time you introduced me? The one time you introduced me at a talk? And people were asking me afterwards, is any of that true? Is that true what Joe said? And literally, not a word of it was true. You made up an entire biography for me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to do. I was amazed people had any doubt that these were not real facts about your family.
No. But David.
Oh, is this the car thief family?
No. That's a different story, Chris. Stay awake, Chris Jack.
One of his parents was like a carnival barker. I don't remember all the details.
It was my dad. I think he met my mom at the carnival, and it was really quite a story. And then,
you know what? It solved the problem I have when I go to talks, which is the intro to talks usually bores me.
Oh, here's the key here's the key to the intro to someone's talk. Here's Joe Heschmeyer, a very fine apologist. We're so delighted to have him here with us. Joe, like, just stop it.
That's all it takes.
You don't need to do more than that.
Even when I watch videos like on YouTube and they include the intros, it's this is 5 minutes. No one.
You know what the worst? The worst is when you watch symposia at universities.
And they read their academic biography.
Do these professors actually think that they're that important? Like, they treat, like,
yes,
nobody.
I think the answer to that is yet.
Well, get over it. Just say the person's name and let them have the microphone. Nobody came to hear this. All right.
If you need to, print that in the printed materials and hand it to them. So if anyone who's like, I don't know if I should trust him, they can read that and then listen to the talk. But it is, it's amazing. People who study Aristotle didn't apparently read the rhetoric.
Yeah.
That's a very nerdy insult, but trust me, that it burns.
Ooh, that hurts. If in any way you are familiar with the works of Aristotle. All right, so the world's deepest thinker and greatest writer, David Brooks, brought down a torrent of comment recently when he published an article in The Atlantic, which was headlined, "The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake."
Sheesh.
Have you heard about this at all? Now, of course, the Atlantic very cleverly took what was a relatively pedestrian argument, I think, and gave it that title because it sounds like that's going to be some crazy left-wing NPR thing.
This was a few years ago, right? Was this recently he did this?
March 2020.
It was 2020.
Okay.
Sai is on the cutting edge.
I thought so.
Because the debate has been renewed on NPR where they are taking this liberal kind of, and I don't mean liberal in the good sense. I mean liberal in the sense of this modern progressivism that sees the family as a threat. But the position that Brooks took, what I thought was pretty pedestrian, and I wanted to ask you about this because the attack on the nuclear family today is generally an attack on the idea of male and female roles. You know, we use the term roles as if everyone's just pretending. The idea that we see a quite vociferous attack on the idea that parents should be the deciders of what their children learn. This is, quite famously, some commenters on cable television saying, you know, well, your children aren't really your own. They belong to the whole community. I think Hillary Clinton took a beating for this with It Takes a Village. But what Brooks was saying in his piece was, look, the nuclear family is not actually a natural occurrence. And I do think that that's a reasonable argument that we need to have.
Yeah.
Because the contemporary argument is saying that 1950s family that you all want to go back to. And I want to always say, as a Catholic, I have no interest in that 1950s family. That was a product of a brutal kind of post-war capitalism that isolated women in the suburbs, stranded them alone, and nobody wants to go back to that.
And Veterans Administration loans.
Oh, yeah, which made Levittown.
Yeah, Veterans Administration loans built the suburbs.
Oh, I'd never thought about that. That's amazing.
They do.
I thought it was racial discomfort.
Well, that was the case with Levittown. Like, no African-American people were allowed to buy a house in Levittown when it was originally built, in the original Levittown. And Matt Damon made a truly horrible movie about that, but I can't remember the name of it now. Suburbia, I think, not Suburbia, but something like that. It's an awful movie, not worth watching, but that did really happen. Black people were excluded.
If what Mr. Brooks means by a nuclear family is something isolated
that is what he means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is a bad idea. Of course.
Yeah, it's true. The proliferation of the nuclear family has not been a positive for the world.
Yeah. No, and my brother is married to a Cuban woman. And the grandparents are part of the family. And I always look at that family arrangement and I think, that's a way better arrangement than the nuclear family. That's a way better arrangement.
Si, you've got me. You're saying Cuban nuclear, and there's a joke there somewhere. I'm just going to leave it alone.
Yeah, no, it's a Che Guevara joke, but don't do it.
I was going to say Bay of Pigs.
No, it's a Che Guevara joke, but don't do it because you remember this Che Guevara that people wear these T-shirts of? Asked Khrushchev to use nuclear missiles against the United States. He didn't want them taken out of Cuba. He wanted them used. Khrushchev said, yeah, I don't think so, Che. Thanks for your help on the matter, but I don't think so. But yes, Che Guevara, your hero, if you're listening and he is your hero, was a jerk who wanted to nuke the United States.
I've probably not had any conversation about Che in years, maybe. And someone this afternoon pointed out that capitalism won when they made those T-shirts.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. Once they put you on a T-shirt, capitalism has had the victory, has had the last word. So I want to talk about family. I just wanted to use this as a jumping off point to talk about family, because I think something so horrible happened to the family after the 1950s. And I remember Dorothy Day saying, and I didn't understand it, but I remember reading her saying, you know, the 1960s, people think that the 50s were a good decade and the 60s were a bad decade. The 60s just reaped the fruits of the 1950s. Yeah. And that we put children in front of televisions. We put mothers by themselves in houses full of children.
And gave them pills.
We sent fathers off in their car away from the mothers, and we excluded the grandparents. And this was the model. And I think Brooks is right, but the modern critics of the nuclear family, or the more contemporary, are wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're seeing, hey, we've really driven into a ditch here. And Brooks is saying, let's go in reverse. And they're saying, let's take a left turn and go deeper into the ditch.
That is it.
Maybe that'll be good.
Yes.
Yeah. And right. So I think they're both right to see the problem. But one set of solutions is insane.
Well, so but even the government, though, got in on the breaking up the families thing with, you know, public housing, for example, often was available to a mother with children, but not a mother and father with children, or welfare benefits that were available to a mother with children, but not. So this is, I think, a well-known phenomenon of the 1970s.
Well, it encourages illegitimacy.
It's this idea that if there's a man in the home, the government, in other words, replaced men.
Yes.
With welfare checks and public housing.
In fact, some feminists admitted this, that women basically had two choices. They either could be married and dependent on a husband, or they could not be married and dependent on the government.
Yeah, and that's exactly
without getting
happened.
Too political, you see a very marked difference in how married and unmarried women vote, which suggests that ordinary women perceive this difference as well. Unmarried women really want big government, and married women are like, this is costing a lot.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think about the young lady a number of years ago. Does this go all the way back to the Obama administration? The young lady who was the law student at Georgetown University who wanted the government to buy her birth control contraceptives, her contraceptive pills.
Right. Well, because the government should buy us everything.
John McCormick of Weekly Standard responded to that by pointing out that this was $9 a month at Target. Yeah. She was going to a $40,000 a year law school.
Yeah. Right. Right. There's
as a Georgetown alum, not our finest.
But what do you think that is really about? Because it's not about the $9. It's about the, hey, in order for me to participate in the workplace the way a man does and to have sexual relationships the way a man does, it's not fair that I have to pay the $9 and he doesn't have to pay the $9. It's not about the money. It's about a weird sense of equality where everybody is reduced to a cog.
Well, it's not equality, it's equity. It's equality of outcome and not equality of opportunity. So it's not saying the government's going to treat everyone equally, because biology doesn't treat everyone equally. And so this is the broad category of what's called pink taxes, that there are certain things women have to pay for that men don't. And there's a lot of women who are outraged by this and say taxpayers should subsidize this. I mean, I don't.
Well, for feminine hygiene products, I actually believe that's true.
Objection to it. It just is the idea that it needs to be a social shared cost. is a very strange argument to make on a principled basis. Because it seems to be saying biology has dealt me a bad hand by being a woman, which I think there's something deeply troubling about that. That's a much bigger issue than the few dollars a month.
Well, yes, because the principle that informs it is that I have a right to fornicate as frequently and wildly as I want. That's a political right that I have.
Right.
And it views femininity as diseases to be treated.
Sure,
or
my fertility is a disease.
Without question, which is what the pill has wrought. The pill has wrought that womanhood is a thing to be medicated out of a woman rather than respected. And, you could redo as my friend Gloria Purvis says, we could have remade the world to work for women, but instead we remade women's bodies to work for the world. And I'm paraphrasing what Gloria says, but that's what happened when you rearrange the hormones in a woman's body so that her menstruation is not getting in the way, her childbearing is not getting in the way. Well, it doesn't get in the way. It's basic to our society. I want to ask you about
Real quick, Chesterton said you can increase the wage or decrease the family, and we know which one businesses will choose.
Yes, right back. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus's teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus's ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What struggles have you faced with your adult kids?
What did you overcome, and how did God work in those situations?
Share your story tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
And now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The flannel panel's here. We're doing the news of the day from a Catholic perspective, talking a little bit about the whole thing about letting go of the nuclear family. The contemporary push, and you may have heard the interviews on National Public Radio, we're talking about the idea that, it's often framed there in terms of roles. And I've always thought the word roles is a propaganda word. It doesn't actually we don't have a role to play as a man, a role as a woman. Those are facts about us. I'm not playing a role when I'm this masculine hunk that I am. I'm trying to wake you two up.
It's not an act. It's not an act. So
this thing happens.
just let this roll downhill for a minute. Let's see where it crashes.
So every time this comes up, it's cast in terms of oppression. So that and there has there as Joe observed in the previous segment, the there is an element of oppression in the woman's role in the family being reduced to the maintenance of or the housekeeping of a suburban home.
Yeah,
because in the pre-industrial age, of course, the woman's role was necessarily integrated into the fullness of the household economy.
Yeah,
yeah, I think like, women, like men, like all people, have a desire for meaningful work that makes a difference and that's appreciated.
Yeah, so
that's, and that's a reasonable human desire.
So this thing almost becomes a caricature of what the facts of the wife in a family are. But anyway, now it's an institution of oppression of children. Especially,
that's it, right? Oh, that's well said, Chris. Yeah,
especially I
that's
think
what this movement
now,
is now.
So if I'm 11 and I identify as a girl,
yeah,
now the this nuclear family or this family is an institute of oppression that's stopping me from, you know, fully actualizing
what my
gender is.
Yeah. That is exactly what I'm hearing on NPR. That's exactly, they're not saying it, but that's the subtext of all of it. And then sometimes it's openly stated. And therefore, we need medical professionals and we need school psychologists, teachers and everybody to be on the kids' side against the family rather than being on the family side.
It's extraordinary how much of, well, I guess this is pretty trite now that I think of it. All these sins are totally sold as freedom, and they are the exact opposite.
Yeah, right.
I want to put forward a thesis that there's kind of three stages to this thing. One is a sense that what you do in the public sphere in terms of work for profit is valuable, and what you do in the private sphere is not valuable. So Chesterton observes that if you take care of your own kids and form them in the faith and make them saints, that's not valuable. But if you watch somebody else's kids for an hour, that's a job.
Yeah, mother. Like, the poem goes, mother is happier turning a crank that increases the balance at somebody's bank.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't. And so that's kind of phase one. Phase two, kids, because family still has to happen. And so how do we think of it now? Now it just becomes these nice little almost consumer perks. And you see this a lot when you hear the conversation around things like gay adoption and in vitro fertilization and everything else, the idea that I'm owed children because I can afford them. And that very kind of consumerist mindset treats kids as commodities. And I think we're now in the third phase of this, which is when you've got this distorted of a vision of family, then the idea there's natural rights and duties between parents and children completely breaks down. And so then it's easy to see the parents just as an imposition on the kids because the kids are just there as a kind of a perk for the parents.
But here's what the dilemma that I wanted to get to then. How do I challenge this National Public Radio view of family, but not be a defender of the nuclear family in its disastrous 1950s form? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What can I propose?
It requires a rhetoric and a vocabulary that is outside of the liberal idiom that we've been operating in since the Enlightenment.
Yeah,
it really does require a Christian idiom, or since the incarnation, that's what we're left with. I shouldn't quite put it that way. That's what we've been given, or some kind of pre-Christian idiom. But but the liberal idiom, which is based on the actualization of the individual, and its origins are in the Renaissance and in the Protestant Rebellion. You have to get outside of the idiom of beginning a sentence with I. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have on one side of the spectrum a radical individualism and the other side of the spectrum everything's about the state, you want to reject both of those.
The family is the only defense against both of those grave errors.
It's a mediating institution between the individual and the state.
Yeah. Right,
and not the family in a nuclear sense, but in a much broader, almost clan-based sense.
Sure.
Not,
yeah.
With a K, with a C.
No, right.
So,
and that's what Brooks was arguing for, was the Klan, the extended Klan, which is what I grew up in.
Can I
mean, I joke sometimes about being from a big Irish Catholic family, but I got dozens, I'm not going to say dozens because I'll make an accidental rhyme, but scores of cousins. I had grandparents, aunts and uncles, you know, that very important parts of my life had nothing to do with just my nuclear family, but had to do with that larger clan that I was privileged to be a part of.
Here is one thing, and I don't even know how, in any broad sense, this way of thinking can be restored, but perhaps in little communities where there is a focus on home, the economy of the home, and homesteading and rural life. But think of marriage as not merely the union of two persons, which it is, the sacramental union, but in fact the union of two families, of the uniting of two families.
Yes.
And this is not a modern notion. It is a medieval notion. If there are ways for us to start thinking about, and when we're making a marriage, are we making a good union of two families? And frankly, now, because we're so deracinated and we've all lived in 10 different cities by the time we retire, or 20, whatever it is, this just practically is a very difficult thing to realize.
It is, yeah, because, right. It's like the you know, oh, we need parishes to be communities again. But when all the people in the parish are mobile and this is just one stop on their career that's going
to
bring
them. I think this is an easier fight to win than the parish one. The parish one, okay, that was a temporary arrangement in the first place, and it may be the days as the locus of activity are functionally done. I'm not ready to sound that alarm now, but it certainly seems things are moving in that direction. But family is not some political arrangement or pragmatic arrangement. It's something written into our nature. And I think the relationship between family and, yeah, like procreation, everything else, is so deep. I was just thinking, when we've had, like, we're pregnant with baby number 3 due in September, and every time both of our families have, or both sides of our family have really stepped up. And they'll inconvenience themselves. Like, my mother-in-law will fly out and stay with us. And I'm just thinking back to, like, Luke 1. Mary, upon hearing that her kinswoman, typically assumed cousin, but someone in the clan, someone in this family, is pregnant and has been pregnant for 3 months, and the first time Mary finds out about it is from an angel. And so they're obviously not just, like, talking to each other every week. Upon hearing this, she arises and with haste goes and stays with her for 3 months. There's no, like, hey, I'm going to send you a letter and congratulate you. Do you need any diapers? Do you need any help? It's like, hey,
right,
surprise, I'm coming to stay with you for 3 months to help you through the last trimester of pregnancy. It's amazing.
Right.
That kind of thing. I would just say, if we are serious about rebuilding this, it's not going to be a federal program. It's not going to be an essay. It's going to be just allowing ourselves to be inconvenienced for the sake of family.
Well said, Joe. I like that. That's well said. It requires something of us if we want these communities to come back. And for one, it requires us to have children, but then not to leave the nuclear. Well, they had the children, you know. But to continue those connections even when they're inconvenient. And, you know, everybody's getting rid of everybody now because my mother-in-law is toxic, you know, all that. Stop it. You know, find a way to move forward, but stop throwing everybody in the trash.
This is an involved topic, but there has been a transfer of wealth from the up-and-coming or the currently laboring generation to the retiring generation. And this has been going on since the post-war period. Now, it's an unsustainable thing in the
form. We hadn't bashed boomers yet. I'm here for it. All right.
Well, but this is in fact what's happened. The so-called greatest generation and then the boomers have been the beneficiaries of an extraordinary wealth transfer that is put from the younger to the older generation.
What's the cause of that wealth transfer? Though?
Social Security. It would be one principal example of it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you you know,
the failure to build housing so that if you're 80 and you've been living in your house for 50 years, that's one less house that's available to the young.
I would say that one way that that older people or retired people who are quite financially comfortable right now can mitigate against the effect of this wealth transfer is help your younger children buy a home. Give them. Yeah.
There are actually laws that make that harder.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So that's right. But that's when we're thinking about tax law, administrative law, business law. If we don't think first, what does this mean for the family? We're blowing it because everything is against the family. I mean, do we still have the marriage penalty for in the taxes? Does that still exist or did we finally take care of that? But I know for, you know, a generation, it cost you money to be married. You know, on your taxes, because it shifted your tax bracket.
Yeah, I think you had to be in a certain tax bracket before that. I think that was an overstated problem. Penalty.
Okay.
Well, I'll give you a real one.
Yeah.
Car seat laws.
Sure.
Right. So most vehicles can't fit three car seats next to each other. So you either need bigger and bigger cars, or you just don't have another child. And that is a huge and, I think, largely unintended cost. But the Freakonomics podcast did a really good job analyzing this and found that there's no safety benefit after the child's two for being in a car seat.
No,
no one had ever tested this to see how does this compare to lack of car seats.
Well, that's what I think about frankly, I've said this before and it gets me in trouble when I say it, but women don't want to be pregnant because we make pregnancy this massive medical trauma that she has to endure. And one of the things that does not hurt a child is a weekly glass of wine for a mother. There's no scientific evidence that that glass of wine does anything to the child, but we punish the mother for 9 months because we have this idea of safety. Well, get over the safety. The woman matters too in that pregnancy.
I'm really glad you keep bringing this up. Sorry.
You know what bugs the heck out of me? Come on.
It does.
I think we've got
why would a woman
want
to be pregnant if we make it intolerable to be pregnant? I'm not saying that you have to have wine to tolerate life. But sometimes you have to have wine to tolerate life.
Especially if it's a good Sauvignon Blanc or a Cabernet. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Malbec. All right, we'll be right back. We're going to talk about the life of the church as it is centered on Rome currently, and we'll see what these two think of how that's all going right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, inviting you to Birmingham for the free EWTN Family Celebration. It's Saturday, August 26th. Enjoy talks from your favorite EWTN radio and TV hosts, including me. You can shop at EWTN's religious catalog, attend Holy Mass, and be part of a televised show. There's even a Eucharistic procession through the streets of Birmingham. Go to EWTN.com/family celebration to find out more and to register. I look forward to seeing you there.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's the flannel panel where we talk about the news of the day from a Catholic perspective, and we do so while wearing flannel shirts. And nobody's happy if I get to the end of these and I haven't asked Chris and Joe anything about Pope Francis, anything about the scandals in the Roman Church. That leaves nobody happy.
Did you clarify?
People want to know. You're happy. It's all this. Well, do we have a CDF anymore? It's not called CDF anymore.
DDF.
It's called Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith.
I can tell you something right now.
Yeah.
When I'm Pope, you know what we're going to call it?
The Inquisition.
Yes,
we're going back to the Inquisition. Nobody expects it, Chris. Nobody expects
it. It's going to be cool. I think I might say the Holy Office.
I like the Holy Office.
That was a nice neutral name. And It's almost a paradox because it's an office, but it's holy.
Yeah. Catholic Answers is. Can we start calling Catholic Answers the Holy Office?
We should.
I'm going to guess.
We should, because it's not being used by anyone else.
That's right.
I'm sure the trademark has expired. Yep. That's ours.
I'm going to put a plaque out there, the Holy Office.
You know, when I said the trademark expired, you want to know something else that bugs me? And I'm just going to digress on this because it bugs me. That the Disney Corporation got the trademark extended on Mickey Mouse for no reason. No, the last time. Because they're the Disney Corporation and they get... No! Trademarks should not go on for centuries.
It is outrageous. Now, they have one argument that I think we should grapple with, which is they keep raising the specter of what would happen if the trademark expired and there was really horrible use of Disney characters and unspeakable ways.
Wait, is there currently a positive use of the Disney characters going on that I'm not aware of?
Is
the Disney Corporation just killing it as far as the quality of the art they're making?
Okay, you know, I think I'm the odd guy out here. And by the way, I have no love loss for anything related to Disney at all.
Okay.
But but this is a piece of intellectual property.
How long
But intellectual
is it?
Property was never meant to be perpetually.
Good Lord. Walt Disney lived and died an extremely wealthy man. His children lived and died extremely wealthy people. His brothers and sisters lived. At what point do we say, okay, that's in the public domain now?
So you're telling me.
So Mark Twain's novels are supposed to be, his family still owns those? Is that what you'd like?
How about the Bible? If I were a descendant of Mark Twain's, I think I would.
Of course, if you were a descendant of Mark Twain's. But in what way does that benefit society for five generations of a family
to be rich?
When
is it supposed to run out there, Lawyer Joe?
By the way,
on intellectual property?
I'm actually looking right now because I don't want to say anything incorrect.
I will say,
I'm going to take all this back if I ever write a book that anybody buys. Then I'm going to be all for generations long intellectual property. Currently, as one of the poorest selling authors at Catholic Answers.
Two generations? I mean, there has to be a time when it... It runs out.
When it runs out, yeah. This is not protecting Walt Disney or his family or any. This is protecting a massive multinational corporation that doesn't need that benefit.
Ken, I don't have any apology for them.
Okay, but none of this is what I wanted to talk about. You all tried to run out the clock on me, didn't you?
So like Calvin and Hobbes,
I don't want to talk about you. I see what you're doing now. I've got what you're doing.
I don't want anybody else to have control over Calvin and Hobbes.
They have a very controversial...
Well, both of those guys have been dead for a long time.
I want to talk about... here's your choices.
Thanks, Chris.
the new Cardinals. Everyone's got an opinion about that, so I figured you two probably have an opinion about that. And
I don't think there's enough.
The new guy, the Cardinal... I shouldn't say guy. Is that disrespectful to a cardinal? The new prince of the church who's in charge of the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith.
Formerly the Inquisition.
Which of these two would you like to talk about? Because we're talking about the church in Rome. You're going to have to do it.
I'm not sure Archbishop Tuco is actually a cardinal.
Oh, he's really?
Archbishop Fernandez.
He's an elect.
So what are you if you're not?
Is he? Was he named in the slate? I may be mistaken about that.
Well, that would be a first.
Yeah, no, I think he's been, come September, right?
But this is, none of this is what I
asked
you.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. Yep, September 30th. Yeah. I didn't realize that. So.
He'll be cardinal. All right. So.
The bigger news was that he was made head of the DDF.
Yeah.
And then attacked Veritatis Splendor.
Yes.
Okay, tell me about that. What does that mean, he attacked Veritatis Splendor, one of the great encyclicals of Pope John Paul the Great? In what way did he attack it?
He said it basically stifled theology, and he said the reason there wasn't anyone on the level of like a Ratzinger, or he gave several other examples, including Gutierrez,
Karl Rahner,
liberation theologian.
Yeah.
Karl Rahner. Was because there were like these two strict limits placed on theology. As if the problem we've been facing in Catholicism in the modern era
is the quashing of wild ideas.
Theologians are too cautious and should be doing more wild
stuff.
It
is kind of funny to think about that.
And it's a really remarkable assessment of the problem from the guy whose job, in theory, is to police bad theology.
Here's what I want.
If he, it's like a police officer saying, you know what? People aren't taking enough risks. Yeah, we've been worried too much about like enforcing the law. People need to be a little more daring. And it's just like, I don't think that's the problem our city's facing.
Here's what I want to observe about the appointment. And you said Tuco? I thought it was Tucho. It's Tuco?
It's probably Tucho. I've pronounced it like Italian.
With respect to his appointment and things that he has said and will say, we are approaching a tipping point. In fact, it's underway already. But the cultural or authority, if you will, or the perception of the authority of the Holy See, it continues to diminish, and that opinion becomes increasingly mainstream. 3 days ago, Edward Faser, hardly a radical, very clear thinker, superb philosophical mind, had a piece in Catholic World Report. Again, hardly, you know, an SSPX journal or something like that, although that's a little unfair because they tend to be among the more sober people nowadays. But Faser has had a piece on Catholic World Report asking if, in fact, we were not in or entering something called the suspended magisterium.
I know. Can I explain that kind of idea?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. And he is using to make his case the Newman's account of what was going on in the fourth century during the Arian crisis.
Which is a really shock. I mean, just the point of comparison.
Yeah.
One of the things to remember is not everything done in the church is the church teaching.
And Faser says so, this. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And but so even more important, sure people, just because bishops are bishops,
there's no magisterium.
Yeah, but he's saying they're not doing their job. He's not saying they're doing their job wrong. He's saying they're just not doing their job.
It's like saying like not everything that happens in a classroom is actually education.
My point here is not to evaluate the merits of Faser's argument. I found it intriguing, and certainly I have some sympathies with it.
Right.
My point is that Catholic World Report, Ed Faser, this is mainstream guys who are now publicly expressing concern about the state of the authority of the Pope Francis and his DDF and his college.
Is it fair to say these are mainstream? How uncomfortable would you be with the phrase ultra conservative?
I would not describe Catholic World Report or Ed Faser as ultra conservative.
And I ask that because the Archbishop himself, Archbishop Fernandez, made this accusation. He said, "These are ultra conservative." His critics are ultra conservative sectors that deeply hate the Argentine Pontiff.
This is nonsense.
He also mentions that it's mostly coming from the United States. I just like how quickly he touches on the nationalism and kind of the ethnic tension card to deflect criticism.
I do have to ask you, is there any, do either of you have the sense that there is a kind of anti-United States bias in this papacy? Sometimes I feel like the comments are indicative of not just a judgment, but a prejudice.
It certainly, there do seem to be elements of that at different levels in this pontificate, yes.
Because I think that's a very low thing to say, people who criticize this man hate the Argentine pontiff. That seems really ridiculously low
and
level.
Right, the word Argentine there is doing a lot of work of insinuating without saying, like, everyone who disagrees with me is actually an anti-Argentine.
I think the worst thing that you could say about Americans in Argentina is no Americans ever think about Argentina.
This is exactly what I was
we
about
don't
to
cry
say.
For
I, was,
Argentina.
I was about to say this exactly until Pope Francis became the Pope. And I would say even now, most Americans couldn't find Argentina on a map.
No, they'd hit Peru or they'd hit Colombia
or Brazil
or Nicaragua or Australia or something. Right.
It's nuts. Pope Francis said, I take it as a badge of honor to, you know, to be criticized by Americans.
I think the most important thing said today is we should stop special privileges for the Walt Disney Corporation and
not genocide Armenians.
Because this is opposed to Disney, I totally support it.
All right. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, Joe Heschmeyer, apologist at Catholic Answers. I am Cy Kellett, host of the radio program here at Catholic Answers. Thank you to all three of us.
You're welcome.
We got nothing for you guys? All right.
God bless you, Cy.
Join us in Rome, CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. See you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.